Blog Talk Radio.
You know what gang violence is? Mostly, and the people don't want you to hear this, somebody shoots your family member. So of course you retaliate.
Right here,
you know what I mean? Same thing the U.S. does, except nobody even shot their family members. You know, some they see somebody bomb a school and all these people get killed, so the United States feel like, ooh, that's messed up. We got to go show them who's the real killer. This country was built on gangs. You know, I think this country still is run on gangs. Republicans, Democrats, the police department, the FBI, the CIA, those are gangs. You know what I mean? The correctional officers. I had a correctional officer tell me straight up, we the biggest gang in New York State. Straight up.
The revolution, the premeditated scheme, introducing drugs on crack to a ghetto team. Got along for born niggas now, play of what it be like. When will niggas see they got us leading with three strikes? Can't seem to focus, hopeless, with violent thoughts I wrote this. Got the devil petrified, hot from my heart to focus. And so I learn to earn my currency in overtime. Affiliated, clearly click a military mind. May God forgive us, over dwell inside of paradise. Thugged out and drug dealing from the womb to the block. My live mind got me surviving five rounds. My 45 got me fortified with live rounds. When shit kick, we block hit. Where I drop sick, all hell, I don't bail. Wrath of apocalypse, forever ghetto necessary. Picture proof, Sam. Outlaw thug niggas never left the proof.
We got a real live shit from front to back. To my niggas in the world, to box to back.
DJ
Now I was born as a rebel, making trouble for the devil. Take this gangbang shit to a whole nother level. Can you feel me now? Armies in every city, definition of power. Players, but you can see the war is the prophecy. Survival is the strategy. Rest in peace to my comrades, that's the seat. Walking out the streets of time, yeah, any devil petrified of a nigga in his right mind. They tell us that we hopeless and hellbound. It's for the brothers of penitentiary, damn, damn. I got you in my heart till the day I die. Think of the damage we could do if we wasn't high. Can you picture me low? It's the thug rap. Political contracts and bloodbath. From a Tulsa core up in the rockets, though they got you. I never let them stop me. The struggle continues.
Now, if we do want to live a thug life and a gangster life and all of that, okay. So stop being cowards and let's have a revolution. But we don't want to do that. Dudes just want to live a character. They want to be cartoons. But if they really wanted to do something, it was that tough. All right, let's start our own country. Let's start a revolution. Let's get out of here. Let's do something.
I'm a soldier for life. The battle I'm fighting has no ending. The struggle is to go the distance. To win is not to care how far one must go.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How do we get access to this, Jackson?
His lawyers say they can get me in posing as a legal investigator.
You were Huey Newton's lawyer, right?
Yes.
And now, Mr. Jackson.
Mr. Jackson was sentenced 1 year to life for a $70 gas station robbery.
We have 2 hours.
Waiting a long time.
We need brothers who can maintain their self-respect in here, have true strength.
Some people are comparing you to Eldridge Cleaver, Richard Wright, Du Bois. How does your fame affect you when you're locked up all day?
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Do you understand that there cannot be a peaceful revolution?
Okay, gentlemen, we're taking over!
Mr. Jackson, sorry about your brother.
They will live to regret it. I'll see you today. You hear me, Eric?
Sorry, Barry Gordon.
from DVCSI.
This is the military, David.
Free land, revolutionary greeting. Welcome to another edition of Jordan Investor Radio, where I'm your host, Bumai Shakur, where our goals are fivefold. Our first goal is to eradicate functional literacy among new African prisoners. Our second goal is to eradicate cultural ignorance among new African prisoners. Our third goal is to transfer the criminal mentality to the new African mentality. Our fourth goal to assist in the rebuilding and stabilization of new African communities. Our fifth goal is to prepare new African prisoners for release, reducing new African recidivism. Before I bring in our guest tonight, I'm going to go to a couple of events that are happening this week during history. And in 1790, on June the 6th, Jean Baptiste Pointe du Sable was a Haitian explorer found in the city of Chicago. 1832 through the 4th through the 13th, the 3rd National African American Convention met in Philadelphia with 29 delegates from 8 states. Henry Simpkins of New York was elected president. In 1833, the 4th North African American Convention met in Philadelphia with 62 delegates from 8 states. Abraham D. Shaw of Pennsylvania was elected president. 1834, the 5th National African American Convention met in New York with 50 delegates from 8 states. They met through the 2nd through the 13th. 1865, Missouri voter ratified a new constitution banning slavery. In 1928, reparationist Callis Hoff died at the age of 67. In 1966, Jane Meredith was wounded by a white sniper as he walked along U.S. Highway 51 near Hernando, Mississippi, on the second day of a 220-mile voter registration march from Memphis to Jackson. In 1977, Joseph Lauder House installed a bishop of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Biloxi, Mississippi. On June the 7th, 1863, three regiments and a small detachment of white troops repulsed the division of Texans in hand-to-hand battle at Milliken Bend, Louisiana. In 1892, G.T. Sampson patented clothes dryer. In 1930, responding to demand from black readers, the New York Times announced that it would begin capitalizing the word Negro. On June the 8th, 1953, U.S. Supreme Court banned segregation at Washington, D.C. restaurants. 1968, James Earl Ray, alleged assassin of Martin Luther King Jr., catch at London Airport. 1982, Leroy Satchel Paige, legendary baseball pitcher, died in Kansas City, Missouri at the age of 75. And also on yesterday's date, we lost one of the comrades, New African Independent Movement. Author, poet, New African communist, the brother Sanyi Shakur, who wrote the book Monster Cody, wrote the book Monster, Autobiography L.A. Game. He wrote the book Thug Life. He also wrote the book Standing the Struggle Forward. And GDU would like to send a solidarity and condolences to the Shakur family, and I was saying to the Shakur family, Sanyi Shakur, and all the individuals who support him. And I also like to read this poem that he wrote in the book Stand Up and Struggle Forward, Kyle, Who Are You? We are the ones who refuse to be captured in Africa without a fight, who stayed there and raised on enemy supply lines and brought our nationals back to freedom. We're the ones who made longer, sharper spears, thicker shields, and turned our backs on collaborating kings. We're the ones who on the high sea en route to the new world brought new forms of combat to bound our oppressors. We're the ones who couldn't be broken, who kept our language in circulation. Our spirit is alive and our minds free of foreign gods and hostile demons. We are those who on the move became Maroons, who settled the Geechee Islands, fought alongside the indigenous nation until we too became indigenous. We are the ones who in the midst of the first 2,000 seasons, 1,000 dry and 1,000 wet, birthed new ideas of national existence and national continuity. We are the ones that whispered strike now to Nat Turner, who plotted and planned with Jeremiah Vesey and Gabriel Prosser. We are the same blood as General Harriet Tubman. We're the ones who didn't need to be freed by the 13th Amendment because we had never been anyone's slave. We're the same ones who laughed and rejected the 14th Amendment to make us citizens of the oppressed nation. And when the so-called Negroes fell for the farce of Reconstruction, we had long been organized and waited for the Klan. When bourgeoisie Negroes formed the NAACP, we formed the African Blood Brotherhood. and he run Negro Improvement Association. And white citizen council attacked the civil rights movement. We scrubbed back at the Deacon for Defense. We're the one who left the right-wing reactionary nation Islam with Malcolm X. We are the ones who organized the ghettos from California to Philly at the Revolutionary Action Movement. We were at the Monroe, Robert and Mabel Williams. We sat at the feet of Queen Mother Moore, Ella Baker, and Dara Abakari. We're the ones who adopted the attacking Black Panther as our symbol. Those who stared down pigs, created Black student unions, and fed free breakfast to children. We sharpened the contradiction. We're the ones who realized the neocolonial nature of the term Negro, changed our national identity to Black. When the term too had been co-opted by opportunists and counter-revolutionaries, we're the ones who converged on December, found the deep and brought to existence a new African national identity. We're the ones who said Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, and South Carolina is a national territory. We're the ones who breathed life into the Black Liberation Army, who proceeded to combat our historical enemies from coast to coast and all areas in between. We were on the roof in New Orleans with Mark Essence in South Central L.A. With Geronimo, we were on the roof in New Orleans with Mark Essence in South Central L.A. with Geronimo Gijaga and El Malik at the Capitol with R.N.A. 11. We were the ones who were in Chicago with Santa Barbara and Spurgeon Jake Reynolds and Attica with L.D. and Sam Mavelle. We were in solidarity with Joe, Fleeta, and John at the American Courthouse with John William James and Rochelle. We're the ones who were with George, Hugo, and Bato in San Quentin. We're the ones from George L. Jackson Assault Squad of the BLA in San Francisco. We're the ones in both Hugo Bala and Amate collecting the Black Liberation Army. And there was us in the 5% of BLA units, too. We invaded the tomb to free our comrades and went on the water to assault Riker Island as well. We're the ones who made Nicky Barnes run to the Italian mob for protection. We're the ones who were in support of the United Freedom Front, the May 19 Communist Organization, the George S. Brigade, the Sam Melville Johnny Jackson Union, and the Prairie Fire John Brandt Anti-Klan Committee. We're the ones who introduced Comrade Sister Asada Shakira to Fidel and Raul. We hooked Robert Williams up with Mayo and Chunala. We're the ones who defended the people in a raging gun battle against pigs at Aretha Franklin Father Church in Detroit. We're the ones who brought you Kawasi Balagoon, Dr. Matula Shakur, Nahandi Abedun, Falani Sunna Ali, Safia Bakari, Yasmin Fula, Afeni Shakur, Sundara Kohli, Malika Shakur Latin, Seiko Ndinga, Jaleel Muta King, Herman Bell, and all the other stalwart standard bearers of liberation. We're the ones who speak truth to power, who practice our theories, who are the messages that we bring. We're the ones in the provision of government Republic of Africa, People's City Council, People Revolution Leadership Council, New African People Organization, New African Panther, New African Scouts, Spear and Shield Collected, Malcolm X Grassmove, Oliver Thurgood Collected, New African Security Forces, Revolution Armed Task Force, New African People Liberation Army, and New African Women for Self-Determination, and we are being many more to come. We are the ones who support Puerto Rican independence, the Mexicano and Chicano movement, the American Indian movement, all other revolutionary struggles for freedom against capitalist imperialism. We are those who stand firm against patriarchy, heterosexualism, liberalism. We are those that study Butch Lee, Jay Saka, Owusu Yaku Yakuba, Choka Lumumba, Makunga Akinyella, Shea Cabral, Fanon, and Dr. Jeremy Clark. We're the ones who know that revolution without women ain't happening. We're the ones the enemy called criminals, terrorists, gangs, militants, leftists, separatists, radicals, feminists, worst of the worst, American warning, enemy combatants, whatever. We call ourselves human. We are new African revolutionaries, those who weren't afraid. Who are you? Free the land. Okay. That's the point I was saying. You secure from the book, sign of the struggle for. Oh, today, day, July the 9th, Dorothy Cotton, civil rights activist, one of the free women in leadership and Southern Christian Leadership Council, born 1948. Oliver W. Hill, led to Richmond, Virginia City Council. 1978, Larry Holmes defeated Ken Norton and became world heavyweight boxing champion. In 2000, Jacob Lawrence, who was widely considered the major living African-American painter, died in Seattle at the age of 82. In 2001, U.S. Civil Rights Commission issued strongly worded report saying that tens of thousands of African-Americans were disenfranchised in the Florida 200 presidential election. On June the 10th, 1854, St. Augustine Healy, first African-American Roman Catholic bishop,
ordained a priest in Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. In 1899, the improved benevolent and protected order of elk finding in Cincinnati. The vessel Arthur Howlin' Wolf Burnett was born in 1910 in Mississippi. He was a legendary blues singer, played guitar, harmonica, nicknamed derived from his voice, large size, and imposing demeanor. Extraordinary singer, who was one of the greatest blues artists that helped make traditional Delta blues popular to a larger audience. In 1940, Otto Mark Garvey, African national leader who called for immigration to Africa, died in London at the age of 52. In 1946, Jack Johnson was the first black heavyweight champion, died after Ottoman accident near Raleigh at the age of 68. And,
on 1964, the U.S. Senate imposed cloture for the first time on civil rights measure in the Southern filibuster by a vote of 71-29. Civil rights bill with public accommodation and fair unemployment section was signed by President Johnson on July the 2nd. Okay, what else? Okay, in 2004, hold up. All right, one more thing before that. In 1997, Geronimo G. Jagger released out 27 years in prison. He was a member of the L.A. Black Panther Charter, a Kaiku African citizen, and a new prisoner of war. Also, on June the 10th, in 2004, singer Ray Charles died in Beverly, California, aged 73. On June 11th, Joseph A. Dixon, the patented piano player in 1912. In 1963, two black students escorted by Federalized National Guard troops enrolled at University of Alabama despite the opposition of Governor George C. Wallace. 1903, President Kennedy told the nation in a radio and TV address that segregation was morally wrong and that it was time to act in the Congress and in your state and local legislature about it and in all our daily lives. In 1967, from the 11th to the 13th, a race riot occurred in Tampa, Florida, where the National Guard mobilized. 1996, playwright and screenwriter Lonnie Elder III died in Woodland Hills, California at the age of 69. On June the 12th, 1963, Marigus Elver, with 37 at the time, NWC Field Secretary in Mississippi, assassinated in front of his Jackson home by a white terrorist. U.N. Undersecretary by a white terrorist. U.N. Undersecretary Ralph J. Bunch, Martin Luther King Jr., and other leaders attended the funeral. In 1963, from the 12th to the 13th, civil rights group demonstrated at Harlem construction site to protest discrimination in building trade union. Demonstration and march were held in metropolitan area in June, July, August to dramatize discontent over housing, school, and job discrimination. In 1967, U.S. Supreme Court ruled that a Virginia law banning racial intermarriage were unconstitutional. Also, 1967, from the 12th to the 15th, a race riot occurred in Cincinnati. 300 persons were arrested, and the National Guard was mobilized. In 1989, U.S. Supreme Court continued its assault on civil rights legislation, ruling that white persons claiming reverse discrimination could seek redress on the civil rights legislation pad to protect black vote workers. In a separate decision on the same day, the court ruled out a belated challenge to a discriminatory seniority system. You know, those are a couple of events that happened the week during history. I'll let you shout out to all those who've been listening to our show since 2014. So shout out to all the ones that in the community educating themselves and doing a particular work. Then shout out to all the political prisoners, prisoner of war, and all the captive citizens who are bettering themselves, who are writing vines, bouncers, and pushing out to the people and circling them through education and means. And not giving up. And I'd like to welcome to the show tonight, Mama Cleo Silvers. How you doing, sister?
I'm really good. Thank you so much, brother, for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the comrades everywhere.
Yes, ma'am. We thank you. Thank you, sister. But before we start, I can tell the people a little bit about yourself before we get into this. They can let the people know who you are.
I really liked that you put up my biography. I was born and raised in Philadelphia, prior to me, my grandfather on my father's side was slaves, and my grandparents on my mother's side were free black people. And they were abolitionists. They worked with Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman and all of the great abolitionists to oppose slavery and to bring an end to slavery in the United States. On the other side, my grandfather's brother became one of the first black bishops in the AME Church, the African Methodist Episcopal Church. My family was an activist family in that we always had information. People needed to see any of the black newspapers or any of the magazines like Crisis Magazine or Ebony or Jet or any magazines, the Crusader Magazine, all that. They could come to my house. They wanted to read books about you know, like W.E.B. Du Bois or 1,000 Lynchings or something like that. People in the neighborhood would come to my house for that. My uncle, my mother and father split when I was 10 years old, and I went to live with my aunt, my father's sister. And at that time, my uncle was just being recruited into the what is considered into the Black Muslim movement. And he was being recruited by my girlfriend down the street's uncle. My girlfriend Beverly Ellis's uncle was Brother Jeremiah X. And Jeremiah X was best friends with Malcolm X. So Jeremiah X used to come to my house when I was about 12 years old. They used to come on Saturday morning, and they would listen to jazz, and they would, Malcolm X said to me, because my job while they were there on Saturday mornings, and they spent like 2 or 3 hours listening to music, and Malcolm X said, well, sister, I guess you know you're going to be a revolutionary when you grow up. I had no idea what he was talking about, but I understood many years later exactly what he meant. So that was, I was 12 years old around that time. Malcolm X was murdered when I was, I think, in 1968, Malcolm X was murdered?
No, 1965.
Okay, so then that means I was 17. That was 5 years later after I had met him, and he had come to my house. Anyway, I became a VISTA volunteer in 67 that year, after I graduated out of high school. I was the first African-American VISTA volunteer, woman VISTA volunteer. And Volunteers in Service to America was the Domestic Peace Corps, just in case anybody don't know what VISTA was. It was the Volunteers in Service to America. It was one of the part of the anti-poverty movement at that time. And I was trained in Baltimore, and my assignment was to go to the South Bronx and work in the South Bronx. The sponsor for the VISTA students that came in was the church called St. Anselm's Church and the New York City Housing Authority. So immediately we went to work at the Housing Authority, and there are two gentlemen there who are working who could not do anything about the housing conditions, although they received thousands and thousands of complaints. But when we got there, they taught us how to do code enforcement. So we went around the community in the South Bronx. South Bronx is a community with the lowest income per capita in the entire United States. That means that their income per capita, per person, was lower than the income in Mississippi and other places. One in four people in the South Bronx was addicted to heroin. The conditions in housing were like the babies were being bitten in the mouth by rats. There was no heat or hot water. It was just horrible. Ceilings were falling in. People couldn't flush their toilets. It was a horrible situation. And we're talking about thousands of a whole community full of conditions like that because the landlords in the South Bronx did not really care about the people in the community. I should mention that when I first came to the South Bronx, the first job that me and my comrade had was to go and to go work in the elementary school that we had been given. We went over to the elementary school, went to the principal's office, you know, little young teenagers going in, and we said, we're here and we'd like to help. Is there anything we can do? And he said to us, you are lovely young ladies coming in here and to helping the community, but these people are nothing but garbage. These people there's no possibility or no chance for them. They're going to be nothing but garbage pickers when they grow up. So if you can do whatever you can think you can do in here, but just by coming in here, you should know that this is a horrible place and that these people are nothing. They're dirt. And that was our introduction to the South Bronx. Of course, as we go on, you know that I was involved. I got a job working as a community mental health worker, and the community mental health workers at Lincoln Hospital were recognized as the Renegade Chapter of 1199 Hospital Workers Union. The leadership, Aubrey Dawkins, Richard Weeks, Danny Argote, Doc Dawkins' wife, Ruth Dawkins, Helena Jones, et cetera. These were the leadership, and they were revolutionaries. And Doc was a red belt in karate, and he had a dojo. His dojo was located next door to the Black Panther Party office on 122nd and 7th Avenue. Because, you know, the workers were moving and they had placed demands on the management, on the administration to stop the use of psychotropic drugs on people in the community, to rather focus on the economic and social conditions in the community, to respect the role of the workers who were closer to the people in the community because we were of African descent or were Latino descent, and we could interact with the community much better than the professionals, white professionals that they were sending in. We demanded to be paid based on our role in working in the community, and we demanded training and upgrading. In other words, we demanded that they pay for our schooling so that we could upgrade ourselves in the field of community mental health. And the union, we were planning to take an action, and the union disagreed with us. And so we staged the first takeover at Lincoln Hospital, and that was the Hospital Workers Union chapter led by Aubrey Dawkins and Richard Weeks. And I had only been in the chapter for about 2 weeks when the takeover took place. But because of my actions and because of my work, they recognized me as a leader and gave me a lot of responsibilities. And one of my responsibilities for the first takeover at Lincoln Hospital was to go to the administrator's office with my team of bodyguards and tell the administration that they had to get out because they were not doing a good job of administering, and they were not doing a good job of delivering quality community mental health care to the community of the South Bronx. And in that process, because Doc was next door to the Black Panther Party office, he had become friends with the Black Panther Party. And when the workers had our takeover, when we had our we staged our protest at Lincoln Hospital, members of the leadership of the Harlem branch of the Black Panther Party came to help us. They came and brought water and food, and they sat down and discussed with us strategy and tactics. They gave us books to read. They were a brilliant group of people. So let me tell you who they were that came up to. That's who was one of the New York 21. He came up. The brother Michael Tabor, who wrote Capitalism Plus Dope Equals Genocide, he came up and helped. Brother Zaid Shakur came. Brother Lumumba Shakur came. Brother Rashid, Brother Ali Bey Hassan came. And, of course, they all came up, and we sat around. They spent a lot of time up there helping the workers figure out what our demands were going to be. More specifically, they raised the question of sickle cell anemia, getting research done, because at that time, when this action took place, there had not been any research on sickle cell. Sickle cell was not even recognized as a disease in the United States. So the Black Panther Party was the organization that raised the question and demanded that the United States recognize sickle cell disease and sickle cell anemia as illnesses that were worthy of research in the United States. While all this was going on, and I was working, you know, to keep the struggle going, members of the Black Panther Party asked me if I would consider becoming a member of the Black Panther Party. That was a tremendous honor for me. It was such a great honor because these were brilliant comrades. They were intelligent. They were caring. They were consistent. They never gave up. And they were there almost 24 hours. Not only that, but they also were selling newspapers. They also ran the free breakfast program. They did so many things. They also were helping the students at Columbia University who had taken over Columbia University, who at the exact same time that the workers had taken over at the Community Mental Health Services. So they were just amazing people. So when they asked me if I would become a member of the Black Panther Party, I was a tremendous honor. And they told me to go if I wanted to do it, and I said yes, that I should go down to the office. And one of the things I was known for, one of the jobs that I had in the Black Panther Party, is that I used to run between the South Bronx and Harlem over the bridge in a very short period of time. Because, you know, of course, you know that the telephone in the office of the Black Panther Party was tapped. And so, I mean, it was consistent. You could hear the police on there listening in almost. And so much so that we never paid a telephone bill. No one in the Black Panther Party never received a telephone bill at our office at 122nd and 7th Avenue. So when something's secure, there had to be any secure communications, they just gave it to me and told me to run it over to the office. Or I would be at the office, they said, run it up to the Bronx, you know. So that was part of my job. There's more. I mean, of course, I spent the rest of a few years involved. When the split happened in the Black Panther Party, the brothers who I had been working with as sisters, by the way, because when I went down to the office to join the Black Panther Party and to fill out my application to be a member of the Black Panther Party, I met the sisters. I met Athene Shakur, I met Gloria Jean, I met Sister Oda Fonda. I met Sister Frankie Malika. I met Sister Janet Cyril. I met Sister Ife. And I'm saying these names. These are very important names. Some of them have passed away. Sister Fanny Chakor was the one who actually spoke to me and showed me how to tie a gele and told me, now you're a real Black Panther sister because you can tie your gele. That's a known story. Everybody knows that story. There's more, and I'm happy to answer questions because I can't wait to hear the questions. Of course, you know, when the split came in the Black Panther Party, the brothers asked me to continue my work, but that they didn't want me to get involved in anything that might be violent clashes between the two sides and the Black Panther. Me over to the office of the Young Lords and asked the Young Lords if they would take me so that I continue my work organizing in healthcare, because that's what I had been doing. I had already established the Think Lincoln Committee, and the Think Lincoln Committee had already established our 24-hour complaint table in the emergency room. And you know the story of the complaint table. The administration used to shut us down every day, and they would tell the security to come and take our table down, and security would come and take our table and all the stuff. Well, I got pictures of this. All of our posters and stuff we had on the wall, and we'd come about 5 minutes later and put it right back up. So it would be a struggle all day long where security would come and take it down, and we would come bring it back to the point where security started just bringing our shit back. Oh, excuse me. Can't come back. And we are our flyers was End Racism in Healthcare. Healthcare is a Right, and the 10-point program for quality healthcare, which became the Patient's Bill of Rights. And I can talk about the details of what was in the Patient's Bill of Rights. After that, you know that the Young Lords had a takeover over the death of Carmen Rodriguez, a young woman who had been given a saline abortion in at Lincoln Hospital. And then after that, there was, of course, we established the community mental health workers. I'd already been talking about the need for a drug program, a drug detoxification program that did not include methadone maintenance. And at that time, 1 in 4 people was addicted to heroin in the South Bronx. And the only program that they had for them was methadone maintenance. And as everyone knows, methadone is a derivative of heroin, but only it's worse. It makes your bone marrow turn into like sand. And when you're detoxing from it, you get very sick, more sick than you do from the detoxing from heroin. You're in pain, and I mean, it's just really a horrible, much worse to detox from methadone than it is to detox from heroin. So I met Panama Alba, 15-year-old brother on the corner, and his friend Butch. And I told them that if they wanted to get off of heroin, they should contact me, because I already knew that we had been planning to have a drug detoxification program. And our plan was to take over the nurses' residence and demand a program, but to already have it established. So with these people who were already heroin addicts, we were able to detox them in my apartment and then send them to meet with some people that took them over to the nurse's residence, where we established a program. And by the time we got in there, there were 200 people standing in line to get detox. And, of course, you know, they didn't like it. The administration didn't like it. But our goal was to get a drug detoxification program. We don't care what they like. Our goal was to get a drug detoxification program established, and we did. That is what we did. So that is the story of who I am, what I've been doing. Of course, everyone knows today I'm living in Memphis, Tennessee. Memphis, Tennessee is 67.9% African American, and this is one of the most segregated cities I've ever lived in my life. I've been organizing, community and labor organizing all around the country, and my experience, I've been in Los Angeles, Chicago, Gary, Indiana, Cincinnati, Boston. I've been traveling and organizing in Los Angeles, everywhere, Louisiana, and New Orleans, and Plasma, just all kind of places. I've been to Georgia, and I know of another place that is more segregated than Memphis, Tennessee. Black people I meet tell me that they are places that they are not allowed to go. So now, one of the things that happened is that black people were not allowed to go to the library or other public spaces like museums, the zoo, swimming pools, department stores, et cetera. They were not allowed to go except for one day a week. And in 1961, the students, and especially the library, this is very important, the students from Lemoyne Owen College staged a protest at the Cox Library and demanded that black people be given an opportunity to use the library like anyone else, like everyone else. And today, that's what I'm doing. I work at the Cossett Library, the first integrated library in Memphis, Tennessee, and I'm working as a consultant and mentoring high school students students from sixth grade through high school. And our program is called How to Stage a Protest, Speak Your Truth. That's it. I'm gonna leave some time for people to ask questions. I'm sorry, it took me a long time to get it all out, but it's a long.
It's all good, Mom. I got a few questions myself.
That's a lot of history.
They entail a lot of different things, right? You know. Okay, you know, and one thing I want to ask was in regards to the Lincoln detox, right? You know, what type of duties and work that you had in regards to dealing with people who were on heroin? What was your relationship to people who were on heroin?
First thing is that I was one of the members of the people who established the program, and my job pretty much was administrative. And remember, my mentor was Zaid Shakur, and it was Zaid Shakur and some of the young lords that had all gotten together with people in the community who established this program. They told me that his brother would be an excellent person to work as the director. So I told him to send his brother to the program and we would interview him. So that's what happened. They sent his brother, Mutulu Shakur, down to the program. I interviewed him and hired him as the director of the drug detoxification program, and it was with him and Panama Alba that the establishment of acupuncture as a methodology for drug detoxification happened. And that's a very important point that you raised.
True indeed. You mentioned Zaid Shakur was your mentor. For the people who don't know who Zaid Shakur is, can you tell us exactly who that was?
Well, Zaid Shakur was actually one of the greatest Black Panthers ever lived. I can tell you that. And nobody's not, there's no dispute in that. Jay was a part of the Shakur family. Now, I don't know their father's name, Shakur name, but he was a part of your Shakur. Saladin Shakur was the father. I met Mr. Shakur and talked with him, spent time talking about culture and education for black people, all that kind of stuff. But he and his two sons were the leaders of the Black Panther Party in Harlem. And they were there for the establishment of the Black Panther Party and the Harlem branch of the Black Panther Party. And that was Zaid and Lumumba Shakur. Fanny Shakur married Lumumba Shakur, I believe, and then later on married Matulu Shakur, Lumumba's little brother. Zaid Shakur was murdered on the New Jersey Turnpike by some police officers who stopped the car with Sundiata Okoli, Zaid Shakur, and Asada Shakur. Asada was wounded, and Sundiata was wounded, but Zaid was killed. He was murdered by the police that night. And that is the loss of a tremendous brother. Zaid Shakur, I'm going to just tell you a story about Zaid Shakur. Zaid Shakur believed in women's rights, and he believed in the equality of men and women in the program and equality of men and women in the Black Panther Party. When we came and had dinner at my house, which we did all the time, if Zaid Shakur was there, he would always get brothers to get together and wash the dishes. I would cook, and Zaid would make sure that the brothers washed the dishes. And this is a true story. He was about what he said he was about. He walked the walk every day. And he was a great and brilliant brother. And I am honored to have had him as my mentor in the healthcare field, as well as a lot of other people from the leadership of the Harlem branch of the Black Panther Party. But Zaid Shakur was one of the great leaders of all time, anywhere in the country, in the world, as a matter of fact. So.
They're quite interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, I heard stories about him being a very outspoken brother, a brother who had a lot of information, and he always with the human rights and always defending people. I heard various stories about the brother. You know, just to hear from your voice and your thoughts, and your experience, it's a beautiful thing. Because you know, especially in regards to like the contribution that the Shakur family contributed, especially into the development of the Black Panther Party, as well as the African independent movement, a couple of developments, influential developments in regards to certain individuals, especially, you know what I'm saying, the Harper Saladin Shakur and his association and affiliation with a lot of brothers and sisters in the Black Panther Party, you know what I'm saying, especially mm-hmm. in regards to the mentorship aspects of things and the teaching, right? You know, as you said previously, that Lumumba and Zaid were actually, you know, were pushing the teaching that their dad gave them, that they were pushing their teaching. Mm-hmm. And also another thing that you mentioned, that Malcolm X, Jeremy X were coming to your house and everything. You know, that's a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Years later after Malcolm X's demise, what actually were your thoughts in regards to meeting him at such a young age? What kind of impact did they have in your life?
Yeah, that was a tremendous impact. Let me tell you, I remember everything. Malcolm X loved Dakota Staten. He brought Dakota Staten's album over to the house. Malcolm X loved Earl Garner. And he loved Nina Simone. So when he would come over, those would be some of the jazz. He also loved newborns. I mean, I remember exactly the music that he enjoyed, and the atmosphere. When Malcolm X came into a room, the atmosphere was calm. You would not believe that he was under so much tremendous pressure because he was very calm, very, very hip, you know, listening to the music, patting his foot, moving his head up and down. Very cool brother. But he also was discussing a lot of important questions about why somebody would want to join the Muslim movement, the things that needed to be done inside the organization, that kind of thing. He was a great man. I mean, I knew at 12 years old he was a great man, but I just was paying more attention to the music that he liked. And I really did not understand until 5 years later exactly that I actually, he had already determined that I was going to be a revolutionary and that I had actually followed through with that movement in my life to become a revolutionary and not to give up for my entire life. So now I'm 74 years old, going on 75. I have not given up yet. I'm still out there struggling. And it is a difficult struggle, but it's worth it, every minute of it.
True indeed.
Bye.
True indeed. No, then. True indeed. No, but it's very interesting that he made that particular statement that you're gonna be a revolutionary, that he saw it in you at an early age. And then another interesting mm-hmm. thing you were saying that your parents had access to all the propaganda, right, at that time. Your house was like a little study center, so to speak, like people come on a study and read or, you know, asking questions. That's a very beautiful thing, you know. So basically at a young age, you know, that you actually involved in culture development at a young age, culture development, study groups, and all that stuff, you know, cell development at a young age,
mm-hmm.
without even knowing what was going on until later on, until you actually got involved in the revolutionary formations, you know, such as the Young Lords and the Black Panther Party, you know. So your upbringing had a lot of benefits to it, you know, that they shaped and mold you at an early age without you even knowing it until you got older. Exactly what you, mm-hmm. exactly what kind of lessons and gifts that you have received to be able to pass on mm-hmm. now, like you're doing right now. You're passing on to me as well as other individuals that are listening, you know. My next question
right.
is, What types of lessons did you learn from Dr. Matula? What type of lesson did you learn from him, and what type of impact did he have over Leaking Details? You know what I'm saying? What kind of impact did he have in regard to the patient become healed, and, you know,
wow.
the programs, you know, and what did you actually learn from him as well?
Wow, wow, wow. Let me just say that. Matula Shakur was one of the greatest. This is another great brother. His contribution to the Lincoln Detox Program could never be really calculated. Matula raised the issue of the need for using acupuncture. He's the one, him and Panama went downtown and got the acupuncture needles. He started training with the brothers and sisters on oranges and on themselves. He was the person that negotiated with the city of New York in order to get the funds to continue the program on. People at the city administration of the city of New York was intimidated by Matula Shakur. But that's one, on the one hand, yes, they were, the administration of the New York City administration was intimidated, but people, the patients loved him. he was loved, absolutely loved by the patients. He was kind and easy and soft. When he put the acupuncture needles into you, you couldn't feel them. He was brilliant. And you know that he ended up going to study in both Canada and China following the thoughts of the barefoot doctors who used acupuncture to deliver quality health care to the people of China. So that idea came to him, came to Matula Shakur by reading about what Chinese were doing to deliver quality health care to their people in China. And the use of the yin and the yang, all of that came out of Matulu and his discussions with the other leadership of the Lincoln Detox Program after he was brought in. But he didn't come in. He wasn't the person that established the program. That was established by us. But once he got in there, he became the key element, the key leader to the drug detox program. And we need to give Matulu Shakur all of his props for that, for his work and his contribution to Lincoln Detox and for the 5-point protocol, because it was Matulu Shakur who brought the 5-point drug detoxification protocol into the Lincoln Detox program. And it still is an important part of the methodology of detoxing a person with the use of acupuncture. And that's called the 5-point protocol. So, yes, Matulu was the core. Now, the other things that Matulu is quite a bit younger than I am, a few years younger than me. Matulu and I used to all the time. We struggled, and I learned a great deal from him. We struggled all the time over whether or not it was correct to have five states in the United States. My position was that after slavery and after we had the people of African descent had worked so hard to build everything in this country, we should own everything. Because we built everything, and because the economic basis for the wealth of this country comes from the sweat of and tears of African Americans, because we worked, and that all of the financial development of this country is based off of the work that we did in the use of cotton as a commodity that they were able to sell and become wealthy, for this country to become wealthy, that we should have all of this and not ask for just five states. But that was me and Matulu. We fought all day and all night. He was at my house a lot. We were close friends. We loved each other. And we never resolved the question of whether or not black people should have five states or whether we should have all the states. The entire country, and that was the issue. But we loved each other dearly, and yes. I loved Matulu dearly. And I was on the Free Matulu Shakur Committee until I left New York and moved down here to Memphis, Tennessee.
Okay. For the people who don't know, can you tell them about the documentaries that you had, the documentaries about Dr. Matulu that you were featured in, and the movies? Can you tell the people the name of it so they can see you in there and see what things you were talking about, as well as learn more about yourself as well as Dr. Matulu, Lincoln Detox? Can you tell the people the name of the movies and publications so they can find
sure,
it for themselves?
Three documentaries out at this time. The first is called Dope is Death, and that documentary is by Mia Donovan, so you know how to look for it. It's an award-winning documentary, and it does centrally focus on Matulu Shakur and his contribution to the drug detoxification program. And it does show my role as a leader in the Lincoln Detox program. And it's a good film. It's an excellent film. The other one that's going to be premiered on Friday night, this Friday, today is Wednesday, in 2 days, is called Takeover. And that one is by Emma Frances Snyder. Takeover is about the Young Lords takeover of the Lincoln Hospital, where we took over because the administration had allowed a Latino woman to die of an untested therapy that they used to give an abortion, a saline injection and abortion. And without asking her, without telling her what they were going to use or anything, they just went ahead just like she was nothing. She was nobody. And just gave her what they thought she should have instead of letting her know what they were planning to do and letting her decide if that was the kind of treatment that she wanted. None of that happened. And that's why there was the takeover, the poor Young Lord's takeover of Lincoln Hospital. And by the way, each time the hospital, there was a takeover or an action at the hospital, people in the community supported it every time. So
okay.
There's a third there's a third documentary by Jenna Bliss, but I'm flaking on the name of it now. I have to go in here and find out. I'll tell you before the end of the show. But anyway, that's what's happening.
Okay.
The premiere is going to be at the Magic Johnson Theater in Harlem on 125th Street. So that's
okay.
That's going to be real interesting.
And it's called Takeover.
Mm-hmm. Called Takeover.
Okay.
There's also going to be another screening at Soundview Park on Sunday afternoon at 4. If you want to get tickets for the one, there's no more tickets for Friday night, but there are tickets for Sunday. Please contact me by email, and I can get you tickets. I can help you get tickets.
Okay. My next question is, you mentioned Dr. Matulu, you know, and the Republic of New Africa. I understand that Lincoln Detox had a political education class, right?
He did,
indeed.
That was at the center. Yeah, that was at the center of the therapy was the political education classes. And that's what made it so effective, that we had political education classes.
Okay.
Yep.
And I also understand that there were a lot of joint efforts between the Black Panther Party and the Republic of Africa in Harlem at that particular time, right? In regards to ministries of information, defense, education, other aspects, right? So I want to ask you, in regard to the Lincoln Detox, was there any RNA cadre that came in there from time to time, or were they actually involved in
any
New African beside Dr. Matulu? Okay.
Yes, you should know that Sister Safia Bakari, who was the leadership of the RNA, is one of my very closest friends, who had also been a member of the Black Panther Party in Harlem. Just so many of the leadership of the RNA, of the Republic of New Africa, was my very close friends, and worked together with them, and they were involved in the Lincoln Detox. They were the relationship between the Republic of New Africa and members of the Black Panther Party were very, very tight. And we struggled over ideology, but ideology did not stop our love for each other. And that we loved each other any one of those members of the RNA could come to any Black Panther and be recognized as their sister or brother. And I have to say that I love, still love, and have relationships with members of the Republic of New Africa. So do many of the Black Panthers, members of the former Black Panthers today. And that's really the truth. That's the honest truth. I'm very close to so many of the leadership. And the organization,
yeah.
Not just leadership, but with the organization, members of the organization too. And I've attended many organizational meetings of the Republic of New Africa. All of the demonstrations that they ever had in New York City, that if I was there, I was always at their demonstrations. So my relationship is very close, almost like I was a member of the Republic of New Africa as a member of the Black Panther
Party.
And later on in my life, yes.
True indeed. You know, it's in that area, there's a lot of things that occur in the area, such as the Oceanville Brownville situation of Bobby Herman Ferguson.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
one of my very closest friends, Ialua, his wife, one of my very tight, closest friends in the world. You're going to make me cry now.
Yeah, you know, I was just, it's just beautiful just to hear this, you know what I'm saying, you know, to hear the particular history and to know the connections myself. Then also, another thing I want to ask you, you know, you said the Black Panther headquarter was on 122nd and 7th, right? At that time, in regard to the street populace and the street community, did you recall any of the five percenters involvement with the Black Panther Party or leaking detox at that time or, you know, anything like that?
Yes. Let me just to say that 5%ers, I know a lot of 5%ers in the community. 5%ers always came up and introduced themselves. As you know, that in front of the Black Panther Party office, we had a record player. And we would play Malcolm X's speeches very loud through the loudspeaker. And the people in the community would come and stand around the office and listen to the Ballad of the Bullet, say. And 5%ers was always there. I mean, it's like they were always there as a part of the community. They were always holding our hands. And they were a little bit deeper into the community than say, the Black Panther Party. And in that sense, they helped us out in so many different ways. They had so much connections, interconnections in the Black community. That's something else that you would ask me that. I know a lot of 5%ers. I know some 5%ers who did not become members of the party but helped the party out in so many different ways, you know. That's amazing.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Another question I want to ask you. It was just so much rich history during that time in Harlem, right? I want to ask you, I also understand that. That Dr. John Henry Clark, Dr. Ben was in the area as well around that time, right? Did Dr. Ben and Dr. John Henry Clark have any connections or relations, you know what I'm saying, with the Black Panther Party or the Lincoln Detox, anything like that in regards to education or political education,
Did
they have any connections?
Of course. You know, one thing about the movement of Black people in Harlem and in the South Bronx and around the community is that we were connected, and the Black Panther Party was completely connected. We had strong connections throughout the community, Dr. Clark came through sometimes to do PE class, sometimes to just sit in somebody's apartment and talk. And what a great opportunity it was for the Panthers to have Dr. Clark come. Or we would go over to City College, where his house was, and go sit at his feet in his basement. Dr. Ben was always in the street. Dr. Ben would be walking down the street and just come by and say hi, you know, and start talking and start training and start educating. And I believe that he did that up in the South Bronx, too, around the Lincoln Depot program. Wow, that's amazing that you remind me how close-knit the entire movement was. We were very close-knit. You could find a member of the Republic of New Africa living in the same apartment that the Five Panthers lived in. You could find Young Lords and Black Panthers and members of the Warkun, the Chinese organization, all living in the same apartment. You know, it was such a close-knit, it was such a close-knit thing. And the people of the community and the leaders of the community loved the Black Panther Party. We were loved by, and we, because we loved the community, because we loved the people, and we did everything. It was known that an older lady, my age, living on the fourth floor, if a Black Panther came past you and saw you getting ready to carry your packages up to the fourth floor, guess what? Black Panthers would take your package up to the fourth, your groceries up to the fourth floor for you. Then, as a result, that's why we would have pots of food. The ladies would be sending down pots of food for the Black Panthers. We never were hungry. And, in Harlem or in the South Bronx. People always made sure that we ate. People brought their clothes down to distribute. One day a shoe factory would come by and just drop off thousands of shoes, and we would distribute them into the community. A cleaner would come by and bring a truckload of clothing that had not been picked up by their owners, and people in the community would come and get free clothing. I mean, in Harlem, all of that happened all the time. So that's why we were so loved. The other thing is that we did not tolerate any drug distribution. And so, and there's Panthers still in jail because they took the drugs from the drug addict, I mean, from the drug dealers, and threw them down the sewer because we did not tolerate any drug dealing in the Black community at all. So that's indeed another thing that you should be aware of, that the Panthers took action on these kinds of things.
Indeed. My next question is, it's interesting you said that you became part of the Young Lord Party, right? You know, my thing was that I wanted to ask was, were you the only person of African descent in Young Lord Party? Was there other people besides you that was a part of Young Lords? And how exactly did the Latinos embrace you as a particular member?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are actually four of us who are African-American to begin with in the leadership of the Young Lords organization. There was Denise Oliver, Carlos, who's African-American. There's myself and a brother named Pelu, who was African-American with a big, huge afro. And because we all have worked so closely in the Latino community. I mean, I spoke a little bit of Spanish. I knew a lot about the history of Puerto Rico and the struggle for independence in Puerto Rico, and was involved in the culture, the Latino culture. But, you know, the thing about being involved in someone else's culture is that you got to be involved in your own culture first. You got to have love and respect and understanding and a deep understanding of your own culture. And that way, it opens you up to embrace other people's cultures. And as a result, yes, I'm still embraced as an honorary Puerto Rican in the Latino community. And that's just the way it is. That's true. But, yeah. That's what's happening.
That's quite interesting. My neck.
Yeah, but you got to learn and understand your own first.
Yeah, you got a point with that. Yeah, know thyself.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the Asian, right? In regards to in regards to the Rainbow, what did the Rainbow Coalition look like in the Harlem area? What did that actually look like? You know, was it functional, or was it all in Ray, or what did it actually look like? You know, the Rainbow Coalition during that time in your area.
Well, the Rainbow Coalition was interesting. We had the White Lightning who came and had political education with the Black Panther Party. We had Iwar Kun, which was an Asian organization. Iwar Kun was down, and they used to come up, and we used to work together. There was door-to-door programs, you know, door-to-door testing. The Red Guard, and then, of course, the Young Lords. So we had a coalition of people that all, and we had the Lincoln Collective, which was the white doctors. And we don't want to forget them because they helped us in many ways. So the Young White Doctors, Igor Kuhn, White Lightning, the Young Lords. We were like chilling, all chilling together, you know. And the Rainbow Coalition was functional, definitely functional. We did political education together. People went back to their own communities and did work in their own communities. But we came together for many, many different things. And we always, if it was going to be a demonstration, we always came together for something like that.
Okay.
Or some kind of event.
My next question. Okay. My next question is, I understand that the Temple of Shango in the area, the Temple of Shango in Yoruba Kingdom. Do you call any kind of collective work that the people from the Shango Temple, the people of Yoruba, participate in a lot of any kind of revolutionary work, so the Panther Party, the Republic of Africa, any formation during that time? Can you recall any of that?
Yes, I do. And all throughout the whole time of my living in New York City, I've always been asked to come and participate with both of those organizations in the events that they have had. You know, it's very funny that we are black people. We recognize and respect each other's culture and what we do. And I've always been asked to participate in their events, to come and speak, to talk about healthcare, all those kinds of things. Yes. That's exactly what
it is. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. know, so I asked him because I understand the histories and I understand that the different personalities. It, like you said, it was a lot going on at that time. There's a lot going on during those years, and there's a lot of development going on from Queen Mother Moore, Bobby Hernan Ferguson, to Baba Seko and Dinga, to Matulu, Saeed. You know, there's a lot of different things going on. You had Matula, the Yoruba, the Young Lord. There's a lot of different things going on during that particular time, right? You know, and my neck. There's a lot of things going on, and a lot of solidarity. There's a lot of solidarity, especially in regards to the PGRNA. Yes, ma'am. The five summers. Right. You know, it was a lot of solidarity in regards to those situations, especially in regards to collective work, in relationship between Black Panther Party and Republic of Africa. A lot of collective work going on, and a lot of Black Panther members were actually in citizens. You know, citizens of the Republic of Africa. You know, so there's a lot of particular work going on at that time, right? You know, and then you know, in regard to the Asian, in your time, I would say that's what I was trying to get out. Yeah, did you meet her?
Of course, I was at Yuri's house for a meeting just about every week. And when Yuri moved to Los Angeles, to Oakland, my husband and I were going on our way out to Oakland. We went to see her when she was in a nursing home out in Oakland, California. So, yes, I've been there. And Yuri's goddaughter, of course, is the granddaughter of my very good friend Pam Hannah, you know. So.
Yeah, from the Black Panther Party,
From the Black Panther Party, that's right. Yes, Yuri is. I was and I were very close.
Yeah, you talking about Kisisei, her daughter. Kisisei, her daughter, right?
Kisisei. Yeah, that's her daughter, and Kasisa's daughter's name is Yuri.
And Pam is one of my very closest friends
in the world. So.
Then the connection next, goes back to, you know, because I think her dad is was a part of New York 3. Dad was part of New York 3. You know, it's an interesting little history in regards to the connection of people there, in regards to the politics, in regards to the struggle, the oppressed. It just real interesting when you hear their particular history and you make particular connections. You understand exactly why we fight for unification. You know, my next question, I want to know more about the medical guidelines that you were talking about earlier. I want to know about the guidelines that you were talking about earlier, right? You know, you're talking about the medical guidelines and everything else.
Right. Well, one of the other things that happened is that we built an organization of hospital workers, some of which, by the way, at the end became members of the BLA and were killed in a shootout with the police, Frank Field. But we built an organization called HRUM, the Health Revolutionary Unity Movement. And HRUM is an organization of hospital workers from Gouverneur Hospital, from Lincoln Hospital, from Metropolitan Hospital, from hospitals all over the city of New York. And we were revolutionary workers. And our goal was to the way in which the system of healthcare related to the patient. And our goal was to get patients to be given the proper respect by doctors, and to establish that in the relationship between doctor and patient, the patient is the most important element of that relationship, and that the patient should be given respect and dignity. Here, I'm going to pull up the 10-point patient's bill of rights. If you hold on just for a second.
Okay.
Pull up the patient's bill of rights for you, because I think that's important for to read the patient's bill of rights for you. Here it is. It's here. So I'm going to have to patient's bill of rights is here. Hold on for a second. Oh, I spelled it wrong. Here it is. Patient's bill of rights. Okay. Number one, the patient should be treated with dignity and respect at all times. Two, the patient should have all treatment explained to and have the opportunity to refuse any treatment you feel is not in your best interest. Number three, the patient has the right to know what medicine is being prescribed for them and what the side effects will be and what they will cause. Number four, the patient has a right to have access to your own medical chart, your medical records. Number five, the patient has a right to have door-to-door preventive medicine programs. Number six, to choose the doctor you want to have and to have the same doctor treat you all the time. To call the doctor to your home, number seven. Number eight, to receive free meals while waiting for outpatient service, including in the emergency room, because at that time they didn't have no food for the patient or water or anything for the patient in the emergency room or any outpatient clinic. Number nine, to have free daycare centers in all hospital facilities. And number 10, to receive free, quality, preventive health care at all times. Those are the rights of the patient. So none of these things were patients did not have the right to any of those things at the time when this was written. But that's it.
Okay. Okay. I want to ask you, okay, I understand the patient got a bill of rights and everything, right? Okay. In regards to the treatment, in regards to the treatment of the patient, in regards to the treatment, you know what I'm saying? I understand you got fluid education. Was fluid education a requirement of the treatment, or was it something that it was optional? Was it a requirement or was it optional?
Oh, no, that's with the drug detox program. That was not. It was a requirement in the drug detoxification program, Lincoln Detox. A part of the treatment was political education. You get acupuncture, you get all kinds of things to help you detox from heroin. And a part of that patient treatment was to have political education. So every patient had to come in and they had to have political education along with their treatment, which was, by the way, not the treatment was no chemicals. They didn't didn't use chemicals to treat you, but it was almost 99%. I think it was almost 99% the drug detoxification program. Successful.
Okay.
So the recidivism rate was very low. That means the rate of people relapsing was very low because they became revolutionaries. They went out into the community. Yeah. They joined the Black Panther Party. They joined the Young Lords Party. You know, they got back out in the community and organized in housing and welfare and all kinds of things. They became members of the union. It was a great program.
Indeed.
And Matulu did a great job leading this.
True indeed. I understand that Dr. Kakaya Patterson came through there as a patient, and he rose up to become a doctor, right? What type of relationship did you have with him? You know what I'm saying? Why he was there?
With who? I'm sorry.
Dr. Kakaya Patterson.
Oh, Dr. Patterson. I actually met him, but I didn't work with him.
Okay.
I did not work with him. But I did meet him. I left in 1973. So the program was going on for 3 years. I left to go to Detroit to become a member of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Can you tell the people more about that organization?
Sure. League of Revolutionary Black Workers, which was led by Mike Hamlin, Ken Cockerell, John Watson. These were revolutionary auto workers in Detroit. They had an organization called DRUM for the Dodge Revolutionary Unity Movement. LRUM for the LRUM, that were all different factories. These were all different factories. For the Cadillac factory, CADRUM, and the league of all of these different RUM revolutionary workers organizations was called the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. I was recruited from HRUM by James Foreman. James Foreman came to town with a brother named Bobby Brown came in and asked me if I would come to Detroit, if I wanted to come to Detroit. And the workers in HRUM said, they thought that was a great idea. Let's send Cleo to Detroit. So I went to Detroit. First, I traveled around the country. And they appointed me as the national organizer for the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, which became the Black Workers Congress. That was Louis Armstrong. I don't know where he came from. But anyway, I went to Detroit. And I worked with the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. I also worked in an auto plant on the line at Dodge Truck. So I was the organizer at Dodge Truck, and I also worked there as a worker. And then after I came home from work, then I went to political education classes and helped organize other workers. And, of course, there's a movie out called Our Thing is Drum. And there's several movies out about the League of, several documentaries about the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. So people should check it out. It's a great revolutionary organization of workers. And some of the workers are also members of RNA, just so you know. Yep.
So in regard to their what type of political education program did they have in regards to their learning? What are you studying?
Well, we were studying Marxism. We were studying the relationship between workers and the bosses, studying the economics. The basis for the economic development of the United States of America. she was, I mean, we went deep into the politics of racism in this country because it was so clear.
Yeah.
It was very similar to the political education. You know, we read a lot of Fanon. We read a lot, an awful lot. We read the Red Book. We read Lenin and Marx and Engels. We did a lot of political education.
Wow.
Yeah.
I never know that. That's quite interesting. That's quite interesting.
Oh,
okay. You know, real interesting. Wow.
Well, you gotta get into the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. It was bad. It was bad.
Yeah, I actually knew a little bit about the history. I first read about them and Dr. Muhammad Atwell, he was turning the world around. I read in his book. He was talking about
that's when I first read about him, you know. We were turning the world around. And Dr. Muhammad Atwell, book, you know,
Muhammad Ahmed is my very good friend, by the way, from RAM. He's another very close friend of mine.
Yep. All the people you know, had that relationship, their Harlem connection was, all the people in Harlem connected, a lot of people were RAM members. From Queen Mother Moore.
Yeah.
Dr. Matulu, Amar Gaidi, Elwood Daly, Solid mm-hmm. Secure, you know, it's a whole bunch of, you know, a lot of them was in RAM, you know, and then,
mm-hmm.
then also,
right.
you get deeper, the first Panther Party that hit Harlem was a RAM-based Panther Party. Before the Panther Party or the Black Rose of Defense came, it was around Bay Panther Party at first.
Well, that's true.
When you look
Sam Anderson was involved in that. Yep. That's the truth. You're not telling the story, you're telling the truth.
Yeah. Yeah, so all the history is connected, you know, the Garveyites, you know, all the Garveyites there, and the
mm-hmm.
Moore Sign Temple, and Five centers and all that.
That's right,
you know,
the Morris Sign Temple.
I was struggling, you know, Baba Sunna Akola talked about a lot of it in a brief booklet, a brief history of New African prison struggle. He talked about all the particular developments that took place, you know what I'm saying, from the con release system all the way up to the current conditions, you know what I'm saying, up until like the
mm-hmm.
late. Like 2000, he talked about all that. You know what I'm saying? For the Black Panther Party, or Republic of Africa, RAM. He talked about SNCC, Civil Rights Movement, all the other aspects of the movement. The Garveyite, he talked about all that stuff, you know, in regards to how it all shaped the mold of as people out in America. It, no matter what we
mm-hmm.
call ourselves, more,
mm-hmm.
call ourselves New African, call ourselves Pan, well, no matter what we call ourselves, right? It's all connected. So the history is a beautiful thing, right? It's a beautiful thing.
It is.
Now I want to ask you, you know what I'm saying? What type of organization were your parents involved in? I know you said some. I know I said in your bio about the Mason East Stars and everything. But aside that, were any of your family like Garveyites or communists or African Blood Brotherhood, anything like that? Growing up?
Yeah. Yes. And of course, you know that my uncle was a member of the Muslims, of the Fruit of Islam. On that side, my father was an activist, and he won't talk about it, but he was part carrying member of the CPUSA. He never discussed it with me. I asked him about it. He wouldn't discuss it. but he was. But the whole community, could, I mean, they were church people. My grandmother was a church person. But what I'm trying to tell you is that in the community, when you wanted to know information about what's happening in the black community around the country, you come to my house. And there was always people there. There was always discussion going on. There was always people unifying around what was going on. I mean, I think we had the first Jet magazine with the picture of Emmett Till on it. That's in 1955. People came to my house to Ebony. Oh, we always had the Ebony magazine, of course. And with Dr. Clark, Dr. Clark had an article, a constant article in the Ebony magazine. It was interesting up until a certain point when it changed hands from the people, the original family that owned the Johnson family. Oh, boy. Yes, the connection.
Yeah.
So the connection is really, really something.
Yeah, that's another thing I asked you about. The ancestor of Jisoo Wayusi. Do you have any kind of connection with him in regards to organizing,
yes,
and educating and stuff like that? You know, the African language and schooling, you know.
Well, Jisoo Wayusi was the leader in the Ocean Hill-Brownsville struggle. And I was in New York at the time. I was still a VISTA volunteer, but I went down to support the workers and to support the struggle in the Ocean Hill-Brownsville struggle. And Jisoo Wayusi was the leader. And I became friends with him around that and have known him and been actively involved in some of the work that he has done out in Brooklyn. And people, I know just about everybody in the movement. Queen Mother Moore used to call me girl. Come over here, girl. And let me tell you something. That's Queen Mother Moore. And how she used to address me, and I used to go sit at, I'm serious, and I used to go sit at her feet and listen to her and Herman. Her, oh, you know, Michael Warren, the attorney, he used to have Queen Mother Moore and Herman and different people come together in his house, and we would sit, young people, at that, and we were the young people, would sit and listen to them talking about their struggles and all the different things that they had been involved in. And it was a great learning event. It was a great learning event.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Sin defeated the elders. Queen
That's right.
Mother Moore.
That's right. It's Queen Mother Moore, Herman Ferguson. Yep. We sit at their feet,
okay,
and literally sit at their feet and listen to them talk about the struggle that they had been involved in, talk about CORE and the activist activities, talking about Jesse Gray and the housing struggle. I mean, you know, I met Jesse Gray over there in Harlem. That's really something.
Yeah.
Mhm. Can you hear me? I think we got lost. I think I lost him. I'm gonna call back again.
Okay. Okay, I'm sorry about the line that dropped. I'm hope your line.
I'm here.
I'm over your line, but yeah. For some reason, I got kicked off. But you know how that goes. You know what time it is.
Yes.
Allow my train of thought, then. Allow my train of thought. But man, wow.
Okay.
Go ahead about that. Go ahead, sis.
Oh no, go ahead, brother. I'm good.
Okay, I want to ask you about can you explain why is it important to support the political prisoners? Why is it important to free people like Coley and free the political prisoner? Why is it important? What is the significance of that?
Let me just say this, Brother Jamil Alameen, Mumia Abu Jamal, all the political prisoners. Brother Chip just passed away. They just had his memorial this week. It was the first and the longest held Black Panther. Jesus. Chip Fitzgerald. So we have all of these people who, as far as I'm concerned, have been framed political activity. And because of what they stood for. And they are now incarcerated because of their politics. And that's why we call them political prisoners, because of what they stand for, because of what they fought for out on the street. And they were such great leaders and so important to the movement that they had to take them away from us. In the same way that they just felt like they had to kill Brother Fred Hampton. I want to say something else, too, that Jamil Alameen, also known as Rap Brown, was almost killed many years ago when the car of Ralph Featherstone that Ralph Featherstone was in was blown up. The goal was to get Ralph Featherstone and Rap Brown and blow them both up. But Rap ended up not going to Washington, D.C., which is where they was on their way to in that car. And so Ralph Featherstone was the only one that got killed. But they felt like because of the leadership, because of the role of leadership, you know that COINTELPRO and the FBI have always, their goal has always been to either neutralize us, to demonize us to the rest of the community and to the world, and to criminalize us. They either demonize us, criminalize us, which includes incarcerating us, or killing us, or destroying our movement. They've spent so much time trying to destroy the movement by removing our top leadership and incarcerating our top leadership. And that's who the political prisoners are today. And when you start to say Sundiata Okoli was one of the greatest leaders. He's now in his 80s, and he should be home. He's not a threat to anybody, and it's horrendous that he should be incarcerated still and not let out of jail. He's ill, Mumia Abu Jamal is another one. Compassionate release is what we're calling for all of these brothers and sisters who are incarcerated, political prisoners who are incarcerated and who are ill and who have been in there for years and years and need now to be home with their families. So, it's our responsibility to fight, to join Jericho, to get involved in the individual committees to free these brothers and sisters, but get involved with whichever way you can, because getting our political prisoners free is very important. It's one of the most important things that we need to be doing at this time. You got another question?
Indeed. You mentioned, you know what I'm saying, like the COINTELPRO, right?
Yeah.
Can you tell us about some of the experiences you had in regards to COINTELPRO attacking and demonizing the hospital? What are some of your experiences?
Well, I can tell you some experiences. The first thing that COINTELPRO wanted to make your life miserable. Their goal was to make your life miserable. Now, I know for a fact that the FBI or some representation of COINTELPRO came to my mother's deathbed. And I don't know for sure. I can't tell you for sure, but that after they left, my mother passed away. They came there and they asked my mother, "Where is your daughter?" And my mother said to them, "You could ask me that question. I do not know. But if I did know, I would not tell you. You would be the last person I told if I knew where my daughter was." And when they left, my mother died. That's number one. Number two, they follow you. They follow you on a day-to-day basis they have also been to homes of members of my family. My family calls them the suits. Oh, they'll call me and tell me the suits was here again asking about you. So they've been harassing my family from the time that I became an activist until today. They went to several of my jobs and threatened my job. I'm telling them it's either Cleo Silvers got to go or your program got to go. And some people let me go because they didn't want their program to be attacked in that way or be wiped out. Places where I was too big, they could
we got like 5 minutes for the show end, right? Can you like... Mm-hmm. Finish up with your final words. Can you finish up with your final words? Your final thoughts.
My final words is that we have to struggle. We have to organize. We have to be unified. And that's what is necessary. We have to understand history. So the Black Lives Matter and all the movements today, get with some seniors that have been active in the struggle. Organize yourselves completely, have a program that you stand for, that you're willing to fight for, and that you're willing to die for. In fact, stand about how the government, what the government's role is, the relationship to you, that they're going to try to attack you and destroy your organization. But stay strong, stay unified, and fight to free the political prisoners, free all political prisoners. That's
true indeed. Okay, I want to thank you for coming to our broadcast to share your knowledge, to understand and share your experiences. I want to thank you for the work you did in the past, the work you do in the present, and the work you do in the future. And if anyone had any loved ones, associate, comrades that are incarcerated behind enemy lines, please look into our website, which is www.georgetownuniversity.com. Again, it's www.GEORGEJACKSONUNIVERSITY.COM. Long live the new African independent movement. Long live the struggle. And free the land. Peace.
Free the land. Peace.
I mean that, sir.
Okay.